Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back. This is the Patrick Madrid Show, as you probably guessed. My number is 888-914-9149. We have lines open for you right now, which is good. So give it a try. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Teresa in St. Paul, Minnesota. Good morning, Teresa.
Hi, Patrick. My question is on baptism. My daughter was married in the Catholic Church. Her husband was Lutheran, but now he says he just believes there's a higher power. He doesn't want to say it's God. So he's kind of changed his views on that since they've been married. They do have three kids. They're doing very well. My daughter said, I don't know that she wants to practice Catholic anymore. She lets me take the kids to church when I'm at her house. But she said, Mom, if you want a baptism, baptize them, go ahead. But I don't believe I can. I talked to the priest at their church. He said, no, she has to come there. Is there anything I can do to baptize them if she's giving me permission?
Well, one thing you could try, Teresa, would be if she gives you permission to not only bring them in for baptism, but also gives you permission to kind of, in a way, help raise them by making sure they get to Mass on Sunday when they get older and be there to help them receive their sacraments. That might be something that the pastor would say, okay, well, under those circumstances, if there's somebody who's going to act on behalf of these children sacramentally and as far as the faith is concerned, then okay. But without anybody to do that, the pastor is going to rightly say, no, I'm sorry, we'd love to get these children baptized, but because then you're going to be leaving them stranded in essentially a pagan household where they will not be raised in the faith and they will not be able to receive their other sacraments. So it does them a disservice. So I completely understand your grandmother's loving heart and your desire to see these children baptized and receive their sacraments. So what I would suggest is keep working on your daughter, keep helping her and evangelize her, and it may well be that she'll come back to a practice of her faith. And then if that happens, then I think the way would be clear. The light would turn green, and then we can get these children baptized. That'd be my advice. Now, I haven't had to go through that thus far, at least. We have 28 grandchildren, Nancy and I, and thank God we've never had to deal with this issue. Now, anything's possible in the future, and only God knows what I may be faced with down the road. But I certainly... I'm very empathetic to your situation, and I could understand why you're anxious to see something happen. But that's the course of action that I believe I would take if ever I had to face this.
Okay, and does the another friend told me to say a prayer to Saint Bridget, and it says say it for 12 years. Are those things real? Like
types of There's a little blue book called the Pietà, which is a wonderful resource for prayers and novenas and things like that. My parents have had those for many years. And I know that there is a novena to Saint Bridget of Sweden, and attached to it are certain promises that if you say this every day for a year or something like that, that certain promises are said to be granted to you. I personally am of the opinion that at the very least, that's pious folklore. It may or may not be actual. And at the very most, it might in fact be something that St. Bridget of Sweden herself indicated, or somebody thought that that's what she said, in which case you'd have more of a pedigree. But either way, I mean, one of the dangers is to think of these novenas in a mechanical sort of way. I'm not saying that you do that, but there is a danger to think that if I put the quarter in the gumball machine and I turn the handle, I'm going to get a gumball. So if I say the novena this way, or if I do a certain number of days, something's guaranteed to happen. And that I don't think is consistent with the spirit of making a novena. The making of the novena is out of trust and patience, waiting on God's time. So I think some people can get their hopes dashed and maybe even their faith in the process if they thought, well, I said all those prayers for a whole year and look, nothing happened. Some people can actually be demoralized to the point of losing their faith. So rather, I would suggest doing novenas, you know, make the novena of Our Lady Undoer of Knots, make a novena to St. Joseph. I mean, I'm very much a fan of praying novenas. It's a very biblical thing to do. But I would say the key is to pray it in faith and expectation that God will work in his time and in the way that he wants it to happen. And it seems like if you do it that way, you're not going to be disappointed. You will be happy with what God winds up doing in the end.
Right. And by taking, I have friends that say, well, just take holy water and baptize them when you're at church. And I know that you can't really do that, right? It's not.
Yeah. Well, you shouldn't do that for this reason. Number one, it doesn't, I don't know why people assume you have to have holy water to baptize. You don't. It can be any water. But the church, you know, the priest will bless the water before he baptizes. But in any case, you don't want to do that outside of some life-threatening situation. So let's say there was a car accident and it looks as though these children may be dying because of their injuries. Well, in that case, absolutely baptize them. You have the right and even the obligation to help that way if you can. But unless they're in danger of death, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't clandestinely baptize your children. I know a lot of grandmas who have done that. They just do it, and they think they've done something really good. And in a way, they have, because obviously baptism is what regenerates the soul, so it's an extremely important thing to do. But in a way, they have not done the child any favors, because now you've got this baptized Catholic who is bereft of the sacraments and bereft of liturgical life and bereft of all the other things that are necessary. So it puts that person in a certain way in an even more difficult position. Because let's say you baptize this little one-year-old, let's just say, and everything's great, and her soul is as pure as the wind-driven snow, and she's filled with sanctifying grace. What happens when she's 15, 16, 18, 20 years old, and she's now fallen into all kinds of mortal sins, and she hasn't received her sacraments? So her position now, in a way, is even worse than it would have been, all other things being equal, you know, because nobody knows when life will end, and we don't know the disposition of the soul after death, so we can't take those things into account except to say that it puts her at a disadvantage if grandma secretly baptized her and nobody knows it, and there's no baptismal record at the parish, and there's no way to follow up on that. It creates some problems that I know grandmas don't want to create, but they do it inadvertently. So, yeah, don't baptize her secretly. Don't do that.
Yeah, no, it's she's just like 40 minutes from me, so, and they go camping every other weekend. So it's just hard for me to say, yeah, I'll go to church every, I'll go down there and take them every Sunday. I know it's not going to be possible, but.
I know, yeah.
I mean,
that would be heroic if you did. Well, it seems to me, Teresa, that the best thing you can do is to evangelize your daughter lovingly, gently, just evangelize her, pray for her and show her good example and show her the joy of being a follower of Jesus and all of the above. And that seems to me that would be the best possible outcome, is if she comes back to a practice of her faith. It's win-win at that point. So hang in there, Teresa, and pray. I'm sure you're praying now, but just keep doing that. Thank you. Let's go to Rick in Greenville, South Carolina. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Hi. How are you?
Oh,
I'm not
well,
supposed
thanks.
To say that. Okay.
Everyone does.
I read an article this morning from the National Catholic Register, a fellow by the name of Larry Clapp. I don't know who he is, or I've got no background on the guy, but he was talking about what the philosophy, theology, the moral theology of Pope Francis. And he claims that Pope Francis is a proportional moral theologian.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, compared that with the natural law, moral theology of, say, Pope John Paul II, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I thought, well, okay, maybe this is what I've been missing all this time, is I can't understand some of our more leftist Catholic friends in why they, for example, keep voting for politicians that are, you know, for abortion and mm-hmm. and why.
How would you boil this down give me the cash value here? What are you driving at?
Well, I don't want to just say, okay, what's your thoughts? But I guess I'm just trying to say, do you think that this is not a good theological position?
Which one? Or, proportionalism?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, absolutely it's not. Now, I'm not here to sit in judgment of anybody, and what your friend's opinion is about Pope Francis, that's his own opinion. So I'm not judging Pope Francis, but let's just talk about proportionalism as such. That was roundly criticized, I would say even to the point of condemning the notion of proportionalism as a theory of ethics. And Pope John Paul II did that in his encyclical Veritatis Splendor, The Splendor of the Truth. And you can read his critique of it, begin, for example, in paragraph 74 and read for, you know, basically until 76. And he lays out a very specific critique of proportionalism, and he juxtaposes that error against the church's perennial teaching that certain acts are, in the case of an intrinsically immoral act, that the ends do not justify the means, and that in the case of proportionalism, if somebody has a generally proportionately preponderate leap, that's not even a word, if the preponderance of that person's life is more sort of tilted in the direction of the good, and maybe a small part of it is tilted in the direction of evil, that we can overlook or minimize the effect of the evil acts simply because it is proportionately better. Now, that's not all that it is, but that's part of it. There's also a related error that John Paul critiques, and this is called consequentialism, where you make a decision about the morality or immorality of a human act on the basis of what you foresee, and that's simply guesswork, what you assume or you think will be the consequences that will result from this. And by looking at these so-called foreseen consequences, you can then say, well, in this situation, maybe that act is really not that bad, because a greater good could come from it, or the proportion of good is more than the proportion of evil, some such things. That's never been the way the church has evaluated human acts. The church, in her moral theology tradition, has always evaluated the goodness or the evil of an act on the basis of the act itself and the intention and the circumstances. And so one of the dangers is to try to apply proportionalism or consequentialism as a way to say, well, you know, if these two men love each other and there's a lot of good that comes out of this, and, you know, stability and love and friendship, and, you know, if they happen to be committing sodomy as well, you know, in their situation, maybe it's not really all that bad, or maybe it's not bad at all. So Pope John Paul II did a Mexican hat dance on those notions. And I've just given you a quick cursory overview, but if you want to read it in his words, I would say read Veritatis Splendor and begin reading in paragraph 73.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's exactly what this article talked about too. And I got to tell you, I think some of this stuff goes to the very heart of the division within the Catholic Church, you know, because you know, it just baffles my mind that I can be talking to someone who continues to vote for people who promote abortion, mm-hmm. but they'll turn around and say, well, we've got too many people on the planet and the planet's burning up, so we got to get rid of, you know, I mean, so they're justifying, you know, things like contraception, mm-hmm. because there's too many people on the planet and the planet's burning up. And, you know, you're like, oh, wait a
Which
minute.
Is objectively not true. Yeah. And the smart people know, Rick, people like you, they know that the problem is exactly the opposite. We're not having enough children, and the fertility rate has gone so low in most of the world that we're facing a severe demographic crisis within a generation or two. We're already starting to feel those effects in places like Japan and Russia and elsewhere. So there's a lot that you just covered. I won't have time to delve into all of it. But again, if you want to become conversant on the issue of consequentialism and proportionalism, read what Pope John Paul II said in that encyclical, Veritatis Splendor. He lays it out, I think, masterfully. Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it. I want to read you an email that came in, and this is going to prove my point. Let's see, where did it go? This is from a listener named Gary who wrote in this morning, in fact, just a few minutes ago from Minneapolis, listening on our 1330 AM station. It says, Patrick, Trump campaigned as a pro-lifer, governed as a pro-lifer, and delivered big time on his pro-life promises, but you preferred to sacrifice the lives of the unborn for a few ugly tweets and a boorish personality, a devil's bargain if ever there was one, and you fell for it hook, line, and sinker. Pro-abort Madeleine Albright couldn't have said it better. We think the price is worth it. Apparently, you do too. God bless you, Gary. This is a glittering example of what I was talking about. This is a great example of somebody who, let me just put it this way, allows emotion and anger to get in the way of analyzing a situation like this, which, by the way, Gary, may I say to you, this is why, as I was saying earlier, I have avoided trying to talk about Donald Trump, Joe Biden, etc., but especially Donald Trump, because of the extreme emotionalism that goes into this, that in some cases seems to blind people on both sides of the issue. And so as night follows day, I predicted I was going to get some of these kinds of emails, and here's one. So I understand more than you realize, Gary, as evidenced by your email to me. I understand far more than you realize that there is the ugly side to the abortion issue, the other side of, I should say this. I understand that he did some good things, and I appreciate him for that, and I laud him for that. And at every step along the way, when the nominations for Justice Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett were in play, I spoke up publicly on this program. Maybe you heard it, maybe you didn't, but I spoke up publicly in my hope that they would be confirmed and to say this was a good thing that they had been nominated, and I hope that they would be confirmed, and more importantly, that I hoped and prayed that time would tell that they were in fact truly pro-life. And so far, so good. We'll see what happens. So you've handed me, Gary, without realizing it, an example of the problem that made me want to avoid any discussion about it, because people, they just start operating on anger, fear, emotion, etc. And that's not a good way to operate, quite frankly. So in all sincerity, I appreciate you sending me that email. Thank you.
Are we clear?
888-914-9149. Back to the phones. Let's go to Joe in Maine. Good morning, Joe.
Hi, good morning, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is kind of a two-part question. I recently had a close, very loved family member who committed suicide. I guess the first part of my question,
we have a Catholic family. Is there anything that can be done to help him in any way, kind of prayer, candle, I mean, the rosary or anything?
And yeah, all of the above. Well, let's take the first part first, Joe. So as with anybody who dies, and in a certain way, particular way, somebody who has committed suicide, pray for God to have mercy on his soul. Never stop praying. Offer masses, pray the rosary. Anything that you would do anyway for somebody who has died, do those things. And don't neglect to pray for him. But in a particular way, it seems to me that you want to ask the Lord to give him the graces before he died to have a repentance so that he would die in the state of grace. Now, you can't change with your prayers now. You can't change somebody's judgment. So if somebody died and is judged by God and went to hell, your prayers now can't change that. But what your prayers now can change is what may have happened in his life before he died and was judged. Because God, being outside of time, is not limited the way we are. So for you, he died in the past, but for God, everything is present. So if I were you, I would ask the Lord to apply your prayers and the masses and the rosaries and whatever other good things you do on behalf of this person to him before he died. Now, an interesting anecdote, and I'll leave it at this. St. John Vianney, the curé of Ars, he was given by God the certain knowledge that a man who had committed suicide by jumping off a bridge in that area, that he actually was saved. And so God gave him this information, and he was able to comfort the family by saying, yes, your father, your husband died of suicide, but God showed me that in the instant, the split second before he hit the water and died, he had an opportunity to repent, and he did repent, and he died in that state, and he's saved. So these things do happen, and we should take them to heart and pray and ask the Lord to have mercy. So that's my advice. I got to run, though. Thanks, Joe. I appreciate it. I'm coming right back. The number is 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. This hour is sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare, the first to offer comprehensive sharing for prescription medications. Check now to see how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Sounds like the Black Keys. Not sure, but it sounds like it. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Greg now in Minnesota. Hi, Greg. Hello, Greg.
Hello there.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Hey, Patrick. I was curious with the other caller about Donald Trump and abortion and stuff. If you vote, say, like, for Joe Biden and he is for abortion.
Me personally? Because I didn't and I wouldn't.
No, no, you just mean I'm generically? Just talking in general.
Okay.
Yeah. No. That if you voted for, say, Joe Biden, are you, in the church's eyes, seen as, not sure how to say it, part of the abortions that are going on or condoning them? I don't know if, I guess, seeing that you're literally part of them, will you be judged on that? An extent.
Well, let's put it this way. Cooperation with evil is the, I think, the issue that you're getting at, and to what extent is somebody culpable to cooperating with evil, or culpable for cooperating with evil? I think that's a clinical way to say what you're asking. And whether it's abortion or some other crime, if you intentionally cooperate with it, and the closer you are to the actual evil itself, so if you're the abortion doctor, the one who's actually dismembering this unborn child, well, you're participating at the white-hot center of evil. You're about as culpable as you could possibly get. If you are a nurse working in an abortion clinic, and you're not there doing the abortion, and you're not even necessarily in the room, but you're in your capacity as a nurse, you're doing other things that directly support the operation of this abortion clinic, you are also culpable for that crime. Maybe a little bit less so, but it's still not only cooperation, it's also what's called proximate cooperation. You're near the evil action. Let's say that you are the roofing contractor and a storm came through and blew the roof off the abortion clinic. And so you're hired, your company comes in to put a new roof on the abortion clinic, and you know that if you accept this job and you put the new roof on the abortion clinic, that even though you've never even been inside the abortion clinic and you've never done anything directly involved with any abortions, but you know in your conscience that if you accept this contract and you put the new roof on the abortion clinic, they can get back to business quickly and start killing more people. And you say, well, I'm going to do it anyway, when you had the option to not do it, you're culpable, but in a lesser degree. Let's say that you are, let's say that you're the guy who owns the company that makes the shingles for the roof. And the shingles for the roof that your company makes are the ones that this contractor is going to buy, and he's going to use those shingles to re-roof the abortion clinic. Well, you too are participating, but you're not culpable because you didn't even know, you know, yeah, I'm making shingles that are going to go on an abortion clinic that will protect it from the elements so that they can kill more unborn babies. But your participation is so remote and it's so unintentional that you are not guilty of anything because you didn't do anything immoral. So as you evaluate in the case of voting for, let's say, a pro-abortion candidate, these are things that have to be taken into account. And if you're voting for somebody, especially because he or she promotes abortion and you're okay with that, or you even want to see more of that, you're definitely, definitely culpable to the extent that your vote helps to contribute to that. But you might vote for a candidate and you're not even aware because you didn't do your due diligence, or it just, for whatever reason, never crossed your radar screen, and you didn't know that that person supported abortion, and in good faith, you voted because she has a really great record on foreign affairs, or she has a really great record on, you know, the economy or what have you. So your culpability would be greatly diminished, if maybe not even present at all. So it's that kind of approach that one needs to take to evaluate the three foundations or fonts, as the theologians say, of a moral act. The first one is the object itself. What is the act you're going to do? Is there anything intrinsically wrong with that action? The second is your intention. Why are you doing this? What is your reason for doing what you're going to do? It may be morally neutral what you're going to do. There's no moral or immoral value to it in itself. But if your intention is to do it in an immoral way, then you got a problem. And then the third thing would be the circumstances. You know, so if you were to throw yourself out the window to commit suicide, that's a serious immoral act to do. Suicide is gravely sinful. But if you are among those who were above where the planes hit on 9/11 in the World Trade Center, and you have a choice between roasting to death because the room you're in is on fire or jumping out the window, well, the circumstances, not to mention your intention, they would make you not guilty of committing a serious sin because you really had no choice. You were trying to get away from the horrible flames. So that would be my advice as you're evaluating whether you're voting for a politician or any other human act that you're considering doing or refraining from doing. Take that approach and analyze it from those three standpoints, and you can be pretty clearly and pretty quickly aware of whether or not this is a good thing to do or not. I hope that helps. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Alex in California. Good morning, Alex.
Hello.
Hi.
I just am amazed how many men are calling about abortion, but no women are calling about abortion. Abortion, of course, is horrible. I don't think women really want to have an abortion, ever. But if you look back in the 50s, what happened with abortion and having no abortion, all the horrific surgeries that were happening in back alleys and such, would you rather see that happen again? I mean, I do think they should put a constraint on the time frame. I mean, it's ridiculous to do it at a late stage. Most women, I think, or young girls, as soon as they find out, try to get it done as quickly as possible. I mean, nobody wants to do this. But sometimes, if you think about it, some girls and some women have no other way to do it but that. I mean, maybe not so much now because young girls getting pregnant is more accepted. But if you think back in the day, how many women, how many girls would be, mostly young girls. I'm thinking about the young girls who get pregnant by boys. And you know how that happens so easily, you know, tricked them into sex and everything.
What about all the girls who were never able to grow up because they were killed in the womb? What about those girls?
I'm trying to say that, yes, it's horrific. It's very horrific, and many people probably...
But wait, why is it horrific? I mean, if you're okay with it under some circumstances, why is it horrific?
I mean, it's a horrific choice to have to make.
Why?
Yes, but some girls...
No, but why, Alex? Why is it a horrific choice?
Because what you're killing an unborn, you know, cells. That could...
Unborn cells? When you go in to have an operation and they take out a lump or a tumor or something, they're killing cells. Why is that horrific? There's nothing horrific about that. But I mean, I agree with you that abortion is horrific. But what about it is horrific? Why should it be horrific if it's just cells?
If you've taken biology, you know, in the very beginning stages, it is a clump of cells.
Right, I understand that. So if you were to go into a procedure to have some clump of cells removed from your body, if it's just a clump of cells, would you call that horrific?
Well, most abortions, if you go in to see a doctor, are not called that. If regular doctors, you know, like gynecologists, will call it a D&C, which they mm-hmm. do in other cases to scrape out, you know, maybe fibroids and such.
Sure, I'm familiar thing. With that. Right, but what I'm saying is that I agree with you that abortion is horrific. I'm just asking, why is it horrific? If it's just a clump of cells, why should that be a big deal?
Well, you know, if you think about it, it is in the long run, but some girls don't have a choice and have it done because they're going to be ostracized from their parents. I think that's the biggest thing. Many of them have it done because they're frightened of what their parents are going to do to them.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there's tremendous pressure that's put on so many young women to have abortions, and that's wrong, and that shouldn't happen. Unfortunately, it does. Many of them, at least from the things I've learned over the years, have felt like they didn't have any other option. Many of them felt like if they didn't have an abortion, they would be disowned by their families, or they would lose a job, or other things like that. So there's great compulsion and fear and pressure that's often put on women. I don't deny any of those things at all. But it remains, nonetheless, that it is still killing an innocent person. Do you believe that people have the right to kill other innocent people?
Do you think that like children, you know, girls, you know, 12 and up who get pregnant, or 12 to 18, you know, mm-hmm. 20 who are frightened at this point, realize all that at that stage?
Well, I'm asking you, do you think that you have a right to kill an innocent person?
Yeah, but do you think their mindset thinks that? They're so.
But I'm asking you, Alex, if you would indulge me, please. Do you personally believe that you have the right to kill an innocent person?
I don't think so. But okay. That's why I think that the girls try to do it as soon as possible before it forms into a fetus.
Well, you know that life begins at conception. Science has demonstrated that. So life begins at conception, and that's a human life from the moment of conception. And what human beings look like at one day or one week or one month, in terms of their development, that's what a human being looks like. It's still a human being, though. It's still a human life. So I'm happy to hear that you don't think that you or I or anyone else has the right to take the life of an innocent person. So why back away from that in the case of a very difficult situation and say, I know, let's kill it. Let's kill it. That'll get rid of the problem.
Yeah, you know what? What if it was like, you know, 12 to 18-year-old boys being handed this? Would it be different? Or is it
no,
just
it
the women?
No, it wouldn't. It would not be different. Because don't forget that child is the son or daughter of the 18-year-old boy. It happens to be in the mother's body, but that unborn child would not be there had it not been for the human father, regardless of the age.
And they always take off, don't they, usually?
Often they do, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so they're left with nobody there beside them. Their parents are going to give them heck. You know, they might get looked down upon by other people. Mm-hmm. Maybe not so much now, but if you think about it in the old days, what mm-hmm. the women and the girls would have to go through. I'm not talking so much about women. I'm talking about girls that get pregnant and saddled with this and don't know what to do, don't know mm-hmm. where to turn. I'm sure at one point
situations.
In their life they're going to say, I'm so sorry I did this. I did this choice.
Mm-hmm.
But to just saddle them to say they're going to go to hell, you know.
Well, gee whiz. I mean, remember it was God who said, thou shalt not kill. So God gave the commandment,
thou shalt not kill. You know,
well, Alex, think about that for a second. God is the one who said, thou shalt not kill. And you and I have already agreed that you don't have the right to take the life of an innocent person. So why use that kind of violence against
abortion or not? There's shootings and killings and fentanyl.
But Alex,
drugging.
Alex, why? I agree with you. Shootings and killings are bad. So why?
So what do you think God is looking?
Alex, I'd like to ask you a question.
The killings that's happening on Earth.
I think God
do you think
is
going to condemn everybody to hell.
I think that those who do those things will go to hell if they don't repent of them. Yes, I do.
The hell is going to be pretty filled up.
Maybe so, but you don't want to go there, do you?
God gives us.
Do you?
God gives us forgiveness.
All right, Alex, I can't have a conversation with you if you won't stop talking and you won't maybe listen to what I'm trying to say. I mean, I agree with you that murder and killing and shooting, those are all terrible things. I'm just wondering why then do you make an exception and say that it is, in this case, okay to kill somebody because they're inconvenient to you? How do you square that?
I'm trying to tell you the mindset of the girl.
I'm asking for your personal opinion. I understand people have different mindsets, but what do you personally believe on this issue?
I'm sorry, the audio faded out.
Okay. I guess what I'm asking, Alex, is, and we're sort of up against a break, so forgive me. I understand your position, and I'm glad you shared it with me. I, like you, agree that we should not kill or shoot or harm people and use violence against them. I completely agree with that. So all I'm saying is I'm consistent and you're not, because as someone who's consistently saying this is wrong, I say it also about abortion, which is the taking of the life of an innocent person. It's using violence to kill somebody, and that's wrong. My respectful point to you is you're being inconsistent, because you recognize the evil of murder, and yet you're willing to countenance it in the case of an abortion.
I'm trying to say that a lot of these girls have no way out.
Granted, but it's not a solution to kill an innocent person. It just creates more problems.
Yeah, but I'm trying to tell you is they feel like they have no way out.
I understand that.
I'm not saying it for the grown women who should know better, but I'm trying to speak up for the young girls.
I understand that.
Who feel they have no way out.
I feel like you're not listening to me,
through
Alex.
Through their pregnancies these days, but I'm trying to reflect about the old days when it was not so accepted to have a child.
Understandable. Well, all I can do is share my thoughts with you, Alex. You asked me to do so. I hope it's helpful. Thank you. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
It's a sin. That's the name of this song. Yeah, abortion is a sin. I hate to break it, but it is. Let's go to Samantha in Buffalo. Good morning, Samantha.
Hey, good morning. So I didn't have a question, but
okay.
I wanted to be possibly the first woman on your show today to call in and let you know that I am pro-life, because I realized the other caller had said that a lot of men were calling in about abortion. So let me be the first woman to call in and say abortion is wrong. That we should do our best to protect life from conception to natural death.
Amen, sister. I agree with you.
Oh, and also, I hope you had a fantastic Taco Tuesday.
Oh, thank you. Thoughtful of you to say so, and I'm glad to know we're on the same page on this issue.
No problem.
Thanks, Samantha. Thank you. Good to talk to you. How about Michael now in Pennsylvania? Hello, Michael.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi.
How you doing?
I am well, thank
yeah,
you.
I am a man calling about the issue of abortion, and I think if you really get to the root of the abortion issue and back it up all the way to the intimate act that results in the life that people are trying to snuff because they think it's a charitable act, really that's a failing on us men because really to engage in that intimate act, you know, you have to give everything. You have to be willing to give everything to that woman. You know, your wife, you have to be willing to give everything to her. And we men that we're just not doing that. And you know, that's definitely one of the root causes of abortion. But the second thing
Well, before you go there, Michael, I'd like to ask you a question. In light of what you just said, where do you fit the scenario where the boyfriend, the husband even, says, I give you everything. I'll pay for this child, education, healthcare, everything. This is my child. I want my child, and I will do everything. And the woman says, nope, sorry, you don't have a choice. And the law backs her up on that. I mean, those things happen with regularity. It's not simply the guy being a cad or a lout and just walking away from it. That happens too, obviously, but there are plenty of times when it's not that way, and the husband or the father at least really, really wants the child to be born and does not want his wife or his girlfriend to have an abortion, and she says no. So you make room for those scenarios too, right?
You are right, Patrick, because that intimate act is a matter of the man giving everything he has to the woman and the woman mm-hmm. giving everything she has to the man. And when one of those people are not willing to do that, then, you know, the problem results, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. You said, I think you said you had a second part of your question.
Oh, yeah, you were talking to the woman, Alex, and you know, she certainly seemed to have a charitable heart, you know, feeling like these young girls that mm-hmm. you know, get caught in the intimate act and maybe they didn't really know what they were signing up for there, and they end up with an unplanned pregnancy. And she seems to think that the charitable act is to like encourage them to get an abortion or to not stand in their way. And I just question whether that really is charitable, because, you know, Jesus said, whoever causes these little ones to sin, you know, it'd be better for them not to be born, or, you know, they should have a millstone put around their neck. And mm-hmm. my gosh, if you're going to strap a young woman with the idea that she's killed another human being, and she's got to carry that for the rest of her life. And that's horrible. I would never want to do that to somebody else. That's
right.
Not terrible.
Right. Yes, I understand where you're coming from. It's a painful topic no matter how you look at it. And naturally, women especially are the ones who are put in that predicament in a way that men are not. And I recognize that, and we have to take that into account. But the reality remains that no one has the right to take the life of an innocent person. And because, as you know, Michael, I know you and I are in agreement on this, life begins at conception, ergo, that is an innocent human life, no matter what it looks like. And to wantonly and intentionally end that life simply because you don't want the outcome, that's a terrible evil. And so we have to speak the truth in love and be sensitive and recognize, as I was saying earlier, the pressures and the fear and often coercion that go into an abortion on the part of men who do this. Not all men, obviously. That's part of the mix too. But the solution is not, hey, let's kill it and then everything will be great. That's just the beginning of more problems. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate your phone call. Let's go to Bob in Illinois. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm a convert to the faith. I've been a Catholic for about 25 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say I'm really struggling at this point and questioning my faith. And it revolves, to segue on the topic here, on abortion, I'm very strongly pro-life and put in time in front of the those clinics to do that, to pray and so on. And it just really... You know, the whole concept of the apostolic succession and magisterium, when our Bishop of Rome picks somebody like this guy McElroy to be a cardinal over obviously men who are trying to, I think, do the right things and teach the faith, it's like, well, what are we doing here? I mean, why? Jesus architected this church to put these leaders in, and then these leaders are leading us into a ditch.
Have you ever read the four Gospels, Bob? I'm sure you have. I mean that question facetiously. I'm sure you've run across a certain figure by the name of Judas, right?
Peter, yes, I know. He denied it three times, but Peter started, but Patrick.
Well, that was Peter. That was Peter. My point is simply this, prescinding from personalities. Just look at the nature of how Jesus established the church. He handpicked 12 men. All of them ran away from him except for John. Peter denied him three times, once under oath. He was the first pope. Judas betrayed him. So let's step back from concerns about people who were made cardinals or bishops or whoever may be pope. Let's step back from that and let's just look at the church as Christ established it and recognize that he himself intended that the church would be populated by great saints and great sinners and everyone in between. So it should not come as a surprise to you, Bob, if during your lifetime you see things that, wow, that doesn't seem consistent with what I thought the church was supposed to be. Here's the great thing, Bob. You and I can only see our little slice because that's the time in which we live. And we have to look at the bigger picture, it seems to me. I think if your concern is, you know, why am I Catholic or why am I staying Catholic and look at what I perceive to be disarray in the church or being at cross purposes and things like that, all of those things being what they are, take some comfort in knowing that Jesus established a church. He said, upon this rock, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And look, the church is still here 2,000 years later. And we've had a whole raft of really good popes. We've had some really bad popes. We've had some incompetent popes. We've had good, bad, and indifferent bishops and a whole bunch of lay people besides, good, bad, and indifferent. And the church is still here. And so that, to me, says Jesus is in charge. Come what may. Popes come and popes go. Bishops come and bishops go. Cardinals come and cardinals go. Lay people come and lay people go. Everything is passing away. But for you and for me, the focus should not be on, do I like these appointments or do I dislike them? You can like them or dislike them. That's okay. You have a right to your opinion. But don't let that be the focus of your faith. Your faith is not based upon Pope Francis. Your faith is based upon Jesus Christ. He established the church. He's the one who arranged it the way it is, and he permits the church to go through whatever it may go through. And my advice would be the same advice I try to take for myself, Bob. Trust Jesus. Trust him. You're on Noah's Ark, and it doesn't smell very good. And it's hard to get a good night's sleep on Noah's Ark, but that's going to save you from the flood if you stay on it. So if you're having any temptations to walk away, I would say don't, because there is no alternative. Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, as St. Peter said. Thank you, Bob, and thanks for giving me an opportunity to give you a little encouragement. Let's go to Jenny in San Diego. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well, thanks.
I just wanted to add to the discussion of abortion. I was listening to the caller from a couple callers ago, and she mentioned how, you know, like young women not having that full mindset of, you know, oh, I'm killing my unborn child. Well,
yeah.
I wanted to bring up the question, what about, like, you know, after abortion and like the mental toll that takes on women and physical?
Right.
I mean, like, our bodies were not made to abort our children. Like, they were made to give birth.
Right.
And I just think that's a very important point to make to everybody, you know, especially those who are pro-choice. Like, you know, God gave us the uterus. Like, there's a reason why we have that, and that is to, you know, be fruitful and multiply. And, yeah, as, you know, difficult as a choice as it is for young women, I mean, we have to remember just the damage that it does. And I don't think people talk about that enough.
That's a good point, Jenny.
Yes, I just wanted to bring that up.
No, yeah. That's a very good point. Very good point. I appreciate it. Well, thank you for adding your voice to this conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for listening. We'll go to Marissa now in California. Hi, Marissa.
Hi, Patrick. Good morning. In response to Alex and as a nice segue from Jenny, I had an abortion in my early 20s, and I have suffered terrible consequences because of it. from suicidal tendencies to not being able to ever have children afterwards. It's been terrible. So, yes, as a young woman, I thought it was the end of the world to have a child. I didn't have support. I turned to the church. I turned to state welfare, and I was denied in every corner. I think that what I've suffered afterwards has been much worse than whatever it would have been at the time if I would have just had the child.
Yeah.
So, there's just so many negative mental and health consequences that are just not publicized. And that's a big problem, is the publicity is not there for what sorts of consequences. It's not just you make a decision today and tomorrow you get on with your life. There's there's a lot that's being hidden from women. And also the help nowadays. When I was 20, there wasn't a lot of pregnancy centers, but now there are more pregnancy centers than abortion centers. So women have places to turn to now. It's just the word needs to get out better, and we're being stifled because it's not, we don't have the media on our side all the time, but it's getting out there. We're doing a better job of publicizing it.
Right. Heart by heart, right, Marissa? Person-specific,
one
heart at a time. Well, what a great way to end the show. Thank you for that, Marissa. Great to talk to you. God bless you. And that goes for all of you. Thank you for listening. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow, and I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.